Right, just start. So I just want to say, yeah, cheers for everybody coming down. This is a wicked crowd and all that. And I'm really tired, but I just wanted to say, I just wanted to say a few things about this bookshop. This person whose idea it was is not here. We've probably beaten to death by now, but we signed the lease for this building on the 22nd of October, and everybody we knew who knew anything about doing this kind of shop thing said you've got no chance of opening in a month. So it's a massive credit to all those people who've been involved. I'm just going to name as many as I can see around here: Steve Mills, Joe, Nick, Rosie, Matt, Annie, and Ian, and Alex. And Mark, who did the sign outside, which is really wicked.
Sam.
And Mike. And Karen, and other people. There's been loads of people who come down here, and I'm so. And Lee, who did all the plasterboarding for us, and brought Laurie.
Lee!
And Gary on the electronics.
And Pete Rose, who's done the plumbing, if you know him, did a wicked job. And so there's a few rough edges in here, which will be ironed out by Tuesday morning. When we open actually as a coffee shop. The idea of this place is three things, which is a bookshop one, because there hasn't been one in Bristol for a long time really, that's been, or at least an established one. Secondly, this would be like a meeting room, which could be used, you know, as a bookshop, meeting room, whatever we want to do with it. And that's open to everybody here who wants to use it. And lastly, we want to put a coffee shop together. A coffee shop, we've got the first two things, a meeting room and a bookshop, just about. And we should have a coffee shop by Tuesday morning when we kind of open 8 o'clock for all the hunters outside. So I just got to say, like, it can be done, right? If we're a bunch of, like, numpties, who between us, probably the average is we don't know what an Allen key is, if we added it all up. But we've learned a lot doing it, and people have, it's been hard. We've fought with each other, we've cried, we've bashed our heads against the wall, we've, like, got very tired, and we've, you know, got away with it basically. So I just like to say thanks to all the other people who helped us from Bristol Wireless Project. I can't name everybody here, but lots and lots of people have done things. Tangent Books, all the suppliers who've helped us out and been positive. And all the people who've helped out, Tony Dyer and other people. So it's been a massive effort of a core of people along with a massive network across the city who've helped and done bits and pieces and inspired us to do it. And really, to do this kind of stuff, it does rely on people giving us inspiration. And that's why I'm going to move on to our speaker now, because a long time ago I wasn't really interested in history. It's ruined my life since then, but I wasn't really interested in history, but I went to a day school in 1987 or something at Sir Werbo's Community Centre, and Ian Bone was speaking at that event, one of the speakers, and he kind of introduced me to two books, which we happen to have on sale here today. But those two books are Making the English Work Class by E.P. Thompson, and The World Turned Upside Down by Christopher Hill. And I would recommend, if you're going to choose the first one to read and you've not read any history, say British history, or you don't know much about British history, I'd say read The World Turned Upside Down, which is about the English Civil War. When Ian explained that book to me, or told me about that, told me some stories out of it, probably slightly exaggerated, but it got me going. And I actually read it a few years later, and I thought, I wish I'd read that when I was 16, because it's a wicked book. Making English Work Class, we also talked about in their meeting, and the stories that came out, when I read it about 10 years ago, it totally inspired me to get involved in looking into the history of working class struggles in this country, which have been massively distorted and hidden for a long time, and it's really only been really highlighted since the 1960s, and we've got a lot of work to do, because there's a lot of hidden heroes in this city alone that are not known. We was going to go on the radio this morning. I know Mark Steeves went on the radio, and BBC Radio Bristol said we want you to talk about four famous figures of history you'd like to have a pint with. And so we thought, well, we'll talk about some Bristolians. Like, so I wanted to talk about four unknown Bristolians, because that was really what Bristol Radical History Group is about. It's about the unknown. I think that's what Ian's going to be talking about today. Because when Ian said, I'm going to talk about six famous revolutionaries from 1919, I reeled a few off and he said, nah. They're too well known. So really, what history's about is discovering the people, and we are those people as well. We are the ones who are going to disappear into history as well. We're not going to be written about by, you know, in this city as being perhaps flavour of the month or anything. So it's up to us to find out about ourselves and ourselves several hundred years ago, the kind of people we are. So that's basically what it's about. Ian's going to talk about 1919. Ian, I'm going to hand you over.
Thank you.
I'm going to sit down most of the time. I'll stand up from the start. My hips give in and I collapse and have to be carried out. Fucking well done. You know, well done everyone. Fucking well done. It's an amazing achievement. And going back to when Peter Linebaugh was here talking about the many-headed Hydra and the brilliant speech he gave. Fantastic achievement. And the name of the stock Hydra, I think, is brilliant. And it's very relevant to the present time. There's been loads of stuff lately about the Occupy movement all over the world, and people have been looking back saying, well, it's hitting everywhere. You know, it's like you chop one bit of the high-headed Hydra off, another head comes up. People have been asking, compare it to what? People compare it to 1968, student revolts all over the world. Paul Mason in Newsnight the other night was comparing it to 1848. So he pays your money, you take your job. I don't know much about 1848. But for me, neither of those are the great revolutionary years of history. For me, the year is 1919, when revolution all over the world did seem possible, and more than seemed possible was actually happening. The Russian Revolution in 1917 had pushed on into Hungary with a communist government there. All over Europe, there were masses of people in motion. In Britain, there was the police strike on Merseyside, Red Clydeside, John McClane in Scotland. All over there were vast amounts of people on the move. It wasn't just people on the move, it was ideas. From the end of the First World War, people were in the wrong place. They were trying to get back to where they were. They were coming across revolutionary ideas all over the place. And obviously the influence of the Russian Revolution was primary and all that, because it gave a hope to somewhere that a revolution could actually happen. It seemed at the time in 1917, hope, optimism, solid ground where there was a revolution. At the same time, the most famous anarchists that we all like were all in play at this time. In 1919, they were all around, they were all politically active. Durruti and Escarza in Spain, Nestor Makhno, Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman, Lucy Parsons, Makhno, Kropotkin, Malatesta, all the great anarchists who we all hail to, even though we're anarchists and we have no leaders. They were all politically active at the time. They were all moving around at the time. So everything was in play. It was a huge day of flux. And one of the things, just before I get into the main drag, is how hard it was to travel in those days that people did. In one biography of Makhno, it says Makhno made his way to the Kremlin. But he was in the Ukraine. He made his way to the Kremlin. It wasn't like hopping on a bus or a train. It probably took him like weeks, months, you know, going across glaciers and icy rivers. You don't, oh, Kremlin, I'll go there, sort of thing. So travel was essentially really hard. There's another geezer called Yakov Sverdlov, who was one of the leading Bolsheviks at the time, was well tipped, you know, up there with Lenin and Trotsky. And according to Victor Serge, used to dress all in leather. with a pass on that one. He was freed from prison in the far east of Siberia in something like June 1917, and made his way by sledge across 3,000 miles of icy rivers, glaciers, this, that, and got there. So these people who moved around, it wasn't like, hey, you know, EasyJet. They fucking took them weeks, fucking years. It was a fucking difficult process to fucking move around. Yeah, so those are the famous. Oh yeah, one thing about moving around. I think my assistants here have a map of the world, which I'm going to refer to, because I want to see how this spread over the world. All on the interns, no money has changed. Right, one thing that fascinates me, in the end of the First World War, has anyone heard of the Czech Legion? Because I'm really keen on the Czech Legion. Although they're not altogether nice. So at the end of the First World War, basically what had happened in the First World War was that the Austro-Hungarian Empire was fighting as well. And they don't get so much of a big write-up as the Germans. But also, the Czechs were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But lots of the Czechs, when they were captured, formed Czech legions and swapped sides to fight for on the Russian side, because they wanted Czech independence from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The trouble was, when the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk and the Russians declared peace, the Czechs were basically fucked, because they were somewhere around here on the East European front. Part of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk is that the Czech legions could no longer go on fighting. Either way, to get home, they had to. They had no one else on their side anyway, so they fought the entire Austro-Hungarian and German empires to get back to the Czech Republic. So what I like is this, they were there, right? So I thought, we can't get back that way. Right, so we could just be hanging around in Russia and be interned to the end of the war. They thought, nah. And this is one campsite conversation I'd love to have been. Some bloke said, why don't we go the other way? I said, what do you mean the other way? They said, why don't we go back to Czechoslovakia? Or, sorry, the Czech Republic. This way. Run across Russia. Over there. Down through Japan. Across the Atlantic. Right across the United States. Back over here. Get there. And then we're back to Czech Republic. Or, sorry, not... what was... And they thought... Yeah, fucking why not? Yeah. I think it's a pretty good idea. And they did. I mean, the whole history of the Czech Legion is incredible. They fought their way across, they fought the Bolsheviks. I mean, they weren't antagonistic to the Bolsheviks, they just wanted to get home. But Trotsky, in one of his duplicitous manoeuvres, said, yeah, you can go back, but you have to give all your weapons up. And quite rightly, the Czech Legion thought, we don't trust the Bolsheviks to give all their weapons up. And they had amazing adventures, you know, they've ended up fighting with the White Armies in the Far East. They also fought the mad baron of Mongolia. Anyway, that was really an illustrated story of how poor people travelled. So they went all around the fucking world just to get home. And they got home, it took them 4 years. And they also, this 4 years, and it's fucking brilliant. And also they had these, hey, Pete Ray. Most of the ability to get there was because they controlled the railways, the Trans-Siberian Railway. And they developed the most incredible moving armoured trains, they were called, which were like huge land battleships. They had huge like guns on back, which could fire like 40 miles. Like, you know, you've seen the dreadnoughts in the First World War. Well, the armoured trains by the Czech Legion, when they went across, they were like that. And the Czech Legion, there was 80,000 of them. And at times they grew even more with local alliances and so on. So the 80,000 people made this huge. So, all right, thank you. That's to show the kind of movement there was, physical movement was possible. And of course, in the midst of all that was ideas. Ah, no, you can put it back up now. Sorry, I forgot. I'm going to illustrate this with one of my favourite anarchists who's not very well known. It's called Simon Radovitsky. Simon Radovitsky. He started off in the Ukraine, which I think, because this is an old Russian map, Ukraine would be somewhere in the breadbasket of the revolution. So he was there, and he was he was 14 years old when he took part in his first strike. But he was wounded by a sabre charge by the Cossacks, and he was in bed for 6 months, and he was jailed for 6 months. At 15, he was elected secretary of his local factory Soviet. This is 15-year-old Simon Radovitsky. He was a marked man by then. So Simon Radovitsky, but he was there in 1904. 10 years later, in 1919, he was here in Tierra del Fuego, not often associated with revolutionary anarchism. So he was there in the Shire. He was imprisoned there. So what had happened to Simon in that time? Simon had his family, because they were named to this, had emigrated to Argentina, where Simon Radovitsky got involved in the syndicalist union, the Fora, very active in there. And the workers, there was a workers' demonstration there in 1909, and the Argentinian police killed 9 workers. Following week, Radovitsky saw where the chief of police, the hated chief of police who'd done the thing, was possible. He tossed a bomb into his car and killed the chief of police and his deputy. He was then going to be faced with execution. He was arrested. He made no attempt to get away, in fact. But because he was under 18 in Argentinian law, he could not be executed. So he was sentenced to life imprisonment. And he was sentenced to imprisonment here, in Tierra del Ushuaia, which is like the southernmost city, town in the world where all the polar explorations take. There's Antarctica. So he was there. He was in prison there for 20 fucking years. 20 years. He was a totally unrecalcitrant prisoner. He was stroppy. He fought for prisoners' rights. He was brutalised in the most horrific way. He was raped repeatedly by the deputy prison governor. Twice he escaped. Now this is Cape Horn here. So escaping in a boat is like not easy. So he was... Some comrades from Uruguay assisted him to escape with local smugglers, but they obviously dare not, in the size of the boat, go around Cape Horn. So basically they just fiddled around in the Beagle Channel there, the disputed area, lots of islands in between Chile and Argentina. And during that 23 days, Radovitsky nearly died. He was totally sick all the time. Imagine the mountainous seas coming. So he might even be relieved when the Chilean Navy arrested him, handed him back. So he's still there in 1930. So there he's there, Ukraine is over, he's 1930, he's still in his shire. He served 20 years, and he's still only fucking 40 years old. Eventually, in 1931, there's a new government in Argentina, agitation by the anarchists, gets him released. He comes back to Argentina on the grounds, but he won't involve himself in any politics. Like, who thinks Simon Radowitzki accepted that? No, he was arrested and imprisoned. He was then deported to Uruguay, where again he was exiled to some islands called the, I can't remember what they're called, off the coast of Uruguay, where we find him in prison in 1936. You might have thought the geezer had earned a bit of a well-earned fucking rest by him. However, our comrade Radowitzki hears of the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War. Gets released, because he wants to go and fight in the Spanish Civil War, travels to Spain, where he fights on the Aragon front for 2 years. Anyone who thinks they're fucking put a lot of work in, this is we stayed up all night putting a few fucking screws in. So he's there. He's in the Aragon front for 2 years. He is wounded. He's 44 years old. He is wounded on the Aragon front. So the rest of the time he works for the CNT, works for the CNT publications in Barcelona till 1939, when the Republican defeat is complete. He goes to France, where he is interned. In Vichy France, he's interned in Toulouse. The Nazis are suggesting, you know, want him, they want him to be executed, this, that and the other. He gets a job at the Uruguayan consulate, which is enables him then to get a boat out, and he ends up in Mexico in the 1940s. Now, there was a lot of people in Mexico, like Diego Rivera, Victor Serge, B. Traven, Rhett Maroutas was. But Simon Radowitzki wasn't on that. He was just a prole anarchist. He had to earn a living. The last 10 years of his life, he didn't mix with the great and the good anarchists. He was just a fucking prole. And he worked in a toy factory for the last 10 years of his life and died in a toy factory penniless in 1956. And that is an incredible story of one anarchist on the move, three continents. An incredible story, but part of the kind of thing that was going on at the time. And Radowitzki really was sort of unknown, but now gradually people have sort of taken up his story as to what an incredible life Simon Radowitzki had. Okay, thank you so much. I'm going to do one other. Oh no, I'm saying thoughts, don't. No, sorry. I'm going to do two people. I'm going to do six lives altogether, but I'm going to do two lives at a time. So if anyone's got any sort of questions or comments, they can come up to them while they're still in mind, rather than wait to the end. And also, I've been talking for far too long. By okay, my second revolutionary is a woman called Maria Spiridonova, and she was a member of the Socialist Revolutionaries in Russia, but a member eventually of the left, what was called the Left SRs, which is the Left Socialist Revolution, but basically a sort of agrarian peasant, represent the interests of the peasants, were full on revolutionaries, the way to the Tsar. They also basically had armed units, assassination units, expropriation units, and so on. But the left SRs, because they were basically peasants, have no sort of political forebears today. So there's no one around here, so I agree with the program of the left SRs, because basically you'd be advocating the collectivisation of agriculture or something. And that probably wouldn't make much sense in fish pond. maybe it would. Okay, Maria Spiridonova, in 1906, she's down here in southern Russia. A hated Tsarist general has just killed 38 workers in a charge. Maria Spiridonova, she was 20 years old at the time, and there's a whole lot of women who were in the left SRs who formed their own assassination squads. One of whom eventually was Dora Kaplan, who shot Lenin. Anyway, she waits at the station, the general comes along, she shoots him in the head, he's dead. She's arrested, makes no attempt to get away. She's absolutely brutalised, she is raped, she's dragged naked through the streets, she's sexually abused on a train it's a nightmare. Then news of this got out, that her brutal treatment, and she was due to be executed, but at the time, one, there was a public outcry in Russia, and two, there was no execution of women in this time in 1906. Although it obviously didn't stop Dora Kaplan being executed later. Anyway, so Maria is exiled right over here in northern Siberia, almost in the fucking, the Arctic. She's exiled there. She's there for 11 years to the Bolshevik Revolution. But in the time, she's not wasting time. There's a sort of all-women's prison unit there, which is basically a training ground for left SR assassination squads. So these women just treat themselves in bomb-making revolvers, and they are fucking, utter out-and-out committed revolutionaries. Again, total privations and so on. 1917, the revolution happens, not the Kerensky one, the early one. 1917, the October one, the Bolshevik All political prisoners, all revolutionary political prisoners are freed, including Mirai Spiridonova. However, she refuses to leave the prison because they're just letting political prisoners out. She stays there for another 3 weeks till all prisoners are released. She travels by train from there to a small town called Chita, where vast crowds have assembled, because Spiridonova's fame has gone before her. Vast crowds are assembled. And she's elected, she doesn't mean to stick it, she's elected mayor of Chita by vast crowds. And then she, her first decree is to blow up the local prison, which she does, actually physically blows it up. So she stays there for 3 months, because she's, in, as you can imagine, in fairly well. Then she travels back across right to Moscow here. I think you put that down for a bit, yeah, thanks. She travels to Moscow, where she immediately joins the left SRs. I'm not going to sit down for a bit. The left SRs at the time were basically the main opposition in the Soviet to the Bolsheviks. And though they represent the peasants, they do have followings in the cities. 1918, Spiridonova and the left SRs have realised that the Bolsheviks are the new Tsars, that basically they got rid of one lot of Tsars to be replaced by another lot. And though they're still in the only party left, the only group left in government, and it's a very uneasy thing. And the crunch comes in July 1918, when the 5th All-Russian Congress of Soviets is called in Moscow. And there's a huge build-up to this. People, Lenin and Trotsky and Sverdlov are going to take on Spiridonova, and this huge, it's at the Bolshoi Theatre. It's a mega theatrical event. Everyone's fucking there. The left SRs come, all armed to the fucking teeth, like. And they're waiting. And Trotsky makes a pretty banal speech, and Sverdlov's not. Maybe he's suffering from the flu, which killed him the year after. And then Spiridonova strides to the stage. She is not a revolutionary. She's not a female revolutionary who would fit the sort of Che Guevara look. She's not wild-haired, she's not flame-haired, she looks like a primary school teacher. She's just, they're very neat, sort of nanny kind of looking woman, small, strides to the stage. She denounces Lenin to their face. Lenin and Trotsky are on the fucking platform. She says, she attacked the dictatorship of abstract theories, and the dictatorship of individuals on this stage who show their adherence to abstract theories. And she made a brilliant case. She was basically a humanitarian. The left SR's policies were a bit all over the place, really. But she was basically wanted to improve society for the good of everyone. She was human. Surely, she said, you want to make things better for people, don't you? What's all this fucking killing everyone and imprisoning everyone? I want to make life better for people. Amazing fucking speech. Spiridonova never wrote anything, so the only record of her is in these speeches. But so she said this big speech about, and the left SRs, meanwhile, are being roused to a frenzy against the Bolsheviks. And in the end, she makes this dramatic thing. She says, if this goes on, if you, Lenin and Trotsky, go on like this, we will come back tomorrow with the bullet and the hand grenade and sort you fucking lot out. And strides off. There's fucking uproar. Lenin strides to the stage and makes what is a halting sort of speech. Dealing with details. He doesn't match Spiridonova's passion. And on the way out, there's more Bolsheviks than left SRs. But the Bolsheviks, it's a bit like handbags at five pack. The Bolsheviks are pushing the SRs a bit. But again, the SRs get their guns out and get out. So you might have thought, well, that's it. Spiridonova, a great orator. But what is she going to do? What's going to happen? Fuck that for that. The following day, Spiridonova and the left SRs are back at the Bolshoi the following day, earlier than the Bolsheviks. And the session is opened. Spiridonova strides to the front with a gun in her hand, shouts, "This is the insurrection, the Bolsheviks are overthrown, long live the revolt, long live the proletariat, long live the peasantry," and declares the Bolsheviks overthrown. Well, she might do that, but would that mean? Yes, it did. At the same time, the left SRs moved their assassination squads into the beast. They shot the German ambassador, Count Mirbach. They seized control of the telegraph office. Felix Dzerzhinsky, who was to become the head of the Cheka, went down to try and arrest the left SRs. He was arrested by the left SRs under gunpoint. At this stage, the left SRs had everything going for them. The Bolsheviks were beaten. They had everything going for them, but they stopped there, as always. They stopped there, and didn't do anything else. In the meantime, the Bolsheviks had very few troops. They had, people think the Bolsheviks in 1918 had plenty of armed people. They didn't. And the only people who saved them was the well-known case of what they called the Lettish Riflemen. The Latvian, a regiment of Latvian riflemen came and militarily disarmed the Left SRs. One, the Left SRs, because they were more agrarian, sort of rural rather, so didn't have that following in Moscow, which they had in the whole country. So basically, there was that seize the time moment when history could have gone either way. The Bolsheviks could have been defeated, although wishful thinking by the anarchists later would never have come into play, Kronstadt, because that was the key point, I think. And Spiridonov had led an unsuccessful uprising against the Bolsheviks, which won, in my opinion, which could have succeeded, and without doubt was an incredibly brave and thing to do. I'll try and finish on Spiridonov now, that she was immediately imprisoned because the prescription against death penalty on women was still in force. And also she was so popular, the Bolsheviks didn't feel that they could execute her. So she was banished to, amazingly enough, if you had the map up, she was banished back very close to, that's no, sorry, we don't need to do that. She was banished back to very close she'd been. So in 18 months, Spiridonova had been in a Tsarist prison, in Siberia, and 18 months later, she was back. The name of the prison had been changed to Bolshevik prison. I think Spiridonova is one of my great heroes. And for the rest of her life, she's basically, before she was put back to Siberia, she was imprisoned in Moscow, where Emma Goldman visited her, because she actually escaped from where she was. And Goldman described her as the most, of all the opponents of Bolshevism, Maria Spiridonova was the most impressive. For the rest of her life, she was in prison in various prison camps in Siberia, so using the cover of 1941, Stalin had her executed on some spurious charge of colluding with the Germans. So again, the travel, and again, a heroic revolutionary, because they have no sort of forebears today, is often forgotten. Right, I better shut up before my voice goes. If anyone wants to raise any questions or add anything more about those two, please do. That's the advantage of picking on obscure subjects. No one's going to come along and say, no, your analysis of the left socialist revolutionaries in the present economy. No.
What's Kronstadt?
Maybe someone else could answer that.
What's Kronstadt? I gave you the pamphlet 2 months ago. Carry on.
If Maria Spiridonova had been successful, then Kronstadt would never have been known in history. Okay, I'll move on to a geezer called Max Holtz. It's H-O-E-L-Z. Max Holtz was just a German worker. He never wrote. He was an absolute proletarian. He never wrote anything. Well, he did. In fact, he did write a very sad autobiography towards the end of his life. Someone who acted rather than thought. He was in the German army up to the Russian Revolution of 1917. When he was politicised by German communists, he became chair of the Workers' Council in Falkenstein in central Germany. And Germany at this time was just full of right-wing nutters, left-wing nutters, anarchists, armed bands all over the place. And basically, Holtz formed what was described as an armed workers' detachment fighting reactionaries in 19... He was accused of having anarchist tendencies. Max Holtz was like a Bash the Rich march with guns and tanks. What he would do, not a permanent army, but an army of maybe 2 or 3,000 people would go back home and stay there and materialise when needed. He was basically the German Robin Hood. And what he would do, he'd arrive in a town, he would lay siege to the town council, the mayor, keep them hostage, demand that grain prices, bread prices reduced to a certain level, expropriate all the local gentry, give all their wealth away to the poor, shoot anyone who opposed him, and move on. This, of course, was great for Max Holtz, but not so good for the people he left behind. basically, it was like, I mean, he was a fantastic proletarian. The German communist, best described here, he was considered by the Social Democrats as a dangerous adventurer, by the official communists as an irresponsible, by the communist left as an anarchist, and by the anarchists as a Leninist. So basically, no one could get a hold on Maxwell because he wasn't a thinker or a writer. He was a doer. And he kept this war up for about 4 years throughout Germany. Well, not throughout Germany, in northern Germany. He often had 200 motorised columns with tanks. The German Communist Party, they liked to portray Max Holtz as one of their own, because they liked his following, the Robin Hood following. But of course, he was totally off message. He was always off message. Eventually, they persuaded him that his life was in danger, which it certainly probably was, and he went to Moscow. But they let him to go to Moscow, to Russia, where they used him as a sort of a popular figure to inspire people. This is what the communists are about. They're all like Robin Hood figures. Several times, Holtz went totally off message denouncing the Bolsheviks. Once they asked him to come to a meeting in the Black Lubyanka, the Bolshevik prison. Not many who went to a meeting there ever came out. Holtz declined that opportunity, but was in fact murdered by the NKVD, the Cheka, in 1932, which was passed off as a boating accident. Good thing about Holtz is that he's just no one knows anything about him. He's just a proletarian. He's got his gut instincts from 1970. He knows what's fucking right. He organises there and then. He doesn't have a master plan. He's not a Lenin or a Trotsky. He doesn't have a master. He knows what's fucking right. He knows the ruling class have to be attacked. He's anti-rich. He knows what needs to be done. Obviously, turning up, declaring, basically, if he's going past here now, he'd declare old Mark at a workers' council, shoot everyone we didn't like and move on. But of course, the sustainability of such a programme is open to question. So, someone asked me a fucking question about Maxwell.
I can't answer it, ask a question. I can observe that the Lubyanka before the Russian Revolution was Lloyd's Bank.
Amazing.
So was he involved in the 1990s?
No, he wasn't involved in the Spartacist rising or any of the up ones. He was like a charismatic local person, basically, who moved around in certain North German area. He didn't seem to link up with the Spartacists or all the Bavarian ones. And the he wasn't a strategic thinker of that, really. He was like, I don't know, it was like an armed Billy Bragg or something. It's very difficult to get that concept in your mind.
Where did he get the tanks and so on? Hmm? Where did he get the tanks and other armaments?
Yeah, there were lots of stuff hanging around, I think. He just sees stuff there and there. His army wasn't there all the time. He would go back into villages and towns and then materialise again. So he didn't need to keep a permanent standing army, but there seemed to be a lot of leftover stuff from World War One knocking around who anyone could see.
There's a fair few mutinies going on as well.
Yeah, so. I mean, there'd been mutinies in Wilhelmshaven, Bremen. Whole of Germany was crisscrossed. Towns could be one minute run by the White Guard elements, right wing reactionaries, the next minute seized by semi-anarchist council communists and so on. So it was a hugely fluid time. But Holtz seems to be forgotten about. Again, he has no communist parties, no vested in. He wasn't really an anarchist. Because he really did, his main political goal was he wanted a bigger and better army, and that was it, basically. For a bit of light relief, then, after all this heavy going stuff, and maybe have a break after that, I'll move on to Jaroslav Hasek, who's a particular hero of mine. Yeah, I mean, have any people here read The Good Soldier Schweik?
Yeah.
That's all of it. He persisted to page 798. Jaroslav Hasek, maybe you don't need the map. In 1919, I should leave where he was in 1919. He's described as the real life creator of the anarchist classic The Good Soldier Schweik. Hasslet was basically a bohemian low-life drunk who I have a lot of affinity for. in an early introduction to his to the Good Soldier's Viking, it's written this. His life was frankly a disgrace. Hasek made a bad start and got steadily worse. After spending much of his dissolute youth as a tramp and dog thief, he joined an anarchist group but bartered the office bike for drink. He then proceeded to edit two rival anarchist papers in Prague, engaged in a polemic with each other. It was a bit, for those who know the anarchist scene in this country, it's a bit as if Albert Meltzer and Bernard Richards were in fact the same person and didn't exist.
Well, Kieran and Trevor Barker.
Yeah. He made his life in various ways. He was a dog thief for almost stealing pedigree dogs, and then passed himself off as a fossil collector. Which helped him once when he'd been arrested. There'd been a riot in Prague and Hasek had been seen to throw a rock at the police. In court he said that he was in fact a fossil collector who'd noticed a very rare fossil which the police were about to stamp on. They tried to throw it out of harm's way and had accidentally hit the chief of police on the head. And Hasek's life is like that. It's bumbling. Did he really mean it? As is the book, The Good Soldier's Fight. For some reason, he got a job as editing a magazine called Animal World in Vienna, which is a very straight, not like geography today, or a very straight. But again, he was thrown out of that after inventing imaginary animals, including werewolves. So basically, by this time, the anarchists had chucked him out as well. His greatest stunt, and this is, I do love this, there were some elections in, obviously, Prague was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Czechoslovakia, as was. And Hasek decided to take the piss out of the elections by forming something called the Party for Peaceful and Moderate Progress Within the Bounds of the Law, which is the most sarcastic thing you could ever dream of. They held many rumbustious meetings, and the Hungarian Empire were very police spies everywhere, and they try and trick Hasek into saying something subversive. Remember, these meetings were always in pubs, need to say. And they tried. There were various police spies at every meeting. Just one example was that. What do you think of the crown? One of the police spies said, hoping that Hasek would say something derogatory about the emperor. He replied, "It's an excellent establishment. I drink there often." On the day of the election, and it can't be said that Hasek. And they said, "Oh yes, you're lucky. My only illustration." There they are on the election day. This is the Party for Peaceful and Moderate Progress, and that's Hasek there, all dressed up for the occasion. Only four of them, so there they are, awaiting the results to come in. But they did not wait for the results to come in, because Hasek, by 10 o'clock, they were drunk. And the polls had only opened at 9 o'clock, and Hasek decided to declare victory. So they plastered Prague with posters saying the Party for Peace had won, and that Hasek was now an elected MP in Vienna, as would be, and they plastered these posters all over. Eventually, the police, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the police wised up to this and came out and sent a policeman over to arrest Hasek. For some infringement of electoral law. Hasek greeted the man and announced that he indeed had been elected, and he promoted the policeman to chief inspector of police in Prague and sent him home on his way to await further instruction. What a top man. In the event, Hasek seemed to have polled 20 votes. But they cobbled together 90 sport ballot papers. Made 100 and they passed it off as a huge triumph. After that, Hasek then went on to write The Great Good Soldier Schweik, and there's loads I could say about The Good Soldier for those who've not read it, but there's three great jokes in the first chapter. He is informed that the Archduke Ferdinand, while travelling in a car in Sarajevo, has been assassinated, obviously the huge event which would lead to the First World War. Hasek replies, "What a lucky man to have a car." Another occasion in the pub where Hasek drinks, they noticed that the picture of the emperor has been turned to the wall. So the police spy Brett Schneider asks Schweiker, why is the emperor's representation being turned to the wall? To which he replies, it's turned to the wall in case a fly shat on it and someone would make an unfortunate remark. Due to his continued agitation in the pub, the landlord falls under suspicion by the police that he might be infected by Hasek. Hasek goes in there after being away for a week. The landlord's wife says, terrible, terrible news. Last week, my husband was arrested and sentenced to 10 years for sedition. Goes Schweik. What good news? What do you mean good news? Well, he served a week already. Hasek eventually, he was enlisted, Hasek as opposed to Schweik, was conscripted in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, forced to fight on the Russian front, which I can't imagine he did with a great deal of enthusiasm. But knowing this sort of chameleon character, we find him in 1919, not at all in prison, not at all fighting for the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but as a commissar in the Red Army. But due to his great bullshit after being arrested, he had first of all been sent as political secretary to the Czech Legion, I met before, and even the Czech Legion, well, I think probably the Czech Legion then revealed to Hasek their plan to march via Manchuria, China, and Japan. Hasek didn't really rate this as a great idea. And so he managed to get himself promoted to commissar in the Red Army for his bullshit. He just basically bullshitted and flanneled. After the end of the war, he made his way back to Prague, where he grew to a vast size. There's another picture on there. He goes to be 26 stone, mainly because he doesn't stop drinking. And when he dies, they can't even get him out the door because he's so fat. And that was the end of Hasek. And he only ever wrote one book, and it's a good soldier's fight, and it's described routinely as he obviously wrote most of it when he was blind drunk. And it's a fucking great book. If you've not read it, then hopefully it'll be in stock here.
It is.
Yeah, if anyone wants to say something about what a great book it is, please do before I go hoarse.
I think the illustrations are fantastic as well. So the content and the illustrations, they gel together.
Yeah, Joseph Lardy, who did the illustrations, a mate of Hasek's, and the illustrations are brilliant. The bizarre thing was that in the late 60s, it was the British ambassador to Prague called Sir Cecil Parrott, who published two books. He became a huge Hasek enthusiast and published two books, one called The Bad Bohemian, or the, as people said, Hasek wasn't a Bolshevik, he was just bullshit. One called The Bad Bohemian and one called The Red Commissar, which are about Hasek rather than Schweik, and well worth a read. Probably available only now in second-hand version, I guess. Like that. You had enough, give in yet? Well, I'll soldier relentlessly on, presuming you're still interested. Let me find the next one. Before I try and find the stuff I put my notes on, here's a quiz question. I'd be interested if anyone knows it. Who are the two people from the United Kingdom who in the 20th century led workers' armies?
He's from Barnsley.
No, he might be. No, he wasn't originally.
There's only three of them.
two people from the United Kingdom who led workers' armies in the 20th century. One's fairly well known. And one ain't.
It's not George Orwell's Second World War Brigade.
His petrol bomb makers at Austerlitz House. No, the obvious. Well, not the obvious one. You don't know where he's born. One was James Connolly because he was born in Edinburgh and led the Irish Citizen Army. The others could be of the. The others is with Percy Fisher. I'm going to talk about briefly Percy Fisher. Percy Fisher was born in Durham. He was a miner in Durham. He was born late 1890s. We know from census returns his family moved somewhere to Derby where he retained to be a miner. Then he vanishes off. Then we do not hear anything about Percy Fisher. Nothing is known about Percy Fisher. Percy Fisher then materialises in Johannesburg We don't know when he got there, but he's certainly there in 1919. So he's gone from there to Johannesburg. He took it down again there. So we don't really don't know when he's. By the time he's arrived in Johannesburg, Percy Fisher is the most unrecalcitrant syndicalist, class warrior, insurrectionist you could ever read to meet. He leads several strikes in the Rand, the gut of gold miners. He's a gold miner himself. And leads several. It's a real class war going on between the mine owners and the mine. The mine workers are all white. They're a mix of Afrikaners and English, and all sorts of other people, but they're not black. And if you look at what the authorities, the mine owners, tried to bring in black workers to undercut the wages of the white workers. A famous photo from this time is an IWW, IWW banner in Johannesburg, seeing a load of strikers go past, reading, "Workers of the world unite for a white South Africa." And you, often in the past, this strike has been complained as a racist strike. And basically, there were racist elements to it. There were elements of not wanting to be undercut, but there were attacks on black workers and so on. There was a strong racist element in it at the beginning. By 1922, Fisher, who's already been in jail for three times, and formed something called the Council of Action, which unites all the most militant mine workers. Fisher throughout has been totally anti-racist. He'd argued against, he's physically stopped racist attacks, but they had taken him. So often in history, this episode is seen as sort of a white working class racist thing. And that's sort of totally changed now, maybe because of one very good book titled White Rising in the Rand by Jeremy Crickler. Come 22, the racist elements have somewhat died away. Although they're still on the fringes, they're not. You know, this isn't to portray a revolution as totally good and bad. There are all sorts of people dealing with gold miners from all over the world. Come 22, it's got to an absolute. Fisher decides only an armed insurrection, uprising, and overthrow of the government will lead to the mine workers' demands. They declare a general strike. All the mine workers in the Rand go on strike. Totally out. They then form their own commandos. Every different area of the gold mine form their own commando units, basically with guns. And again, a lot of them had fought in the First World War, so lots of guns about. And they had the military discipline they got from the. There were two commandos. There was a Sinn Féin commando form. Different nationalities form their own own strike commandos named after different people from their country. The miners quickly seize control of most of Johannesburg and they can seize control of all of the Rand, the gold mining areas. They dug in trenches, they had machine guns, they had cannon, they paraded about in military uniform. They also allied with some of the sort of Boer farmers from the Orange Free State, or Orange Free Colonies it was at the time. They obviously didn't have the same demands, but were interested in overthrowing the government. They also expected these to ride to their aid. Unfortunately, for technology, the aeroplanes had just started to come in, and the South African government had four aeroplanes which they'd never used. This is the first example of aeroplanes being used against strikers in history. They had four aeroplanes that they proceeded to bomb the strikers with. And that was a potent weapon which they found very difficult to deal with, even though they managed to shoot one down and caused a lot of damage to others. The problem with Fisher, again like Marius Brilliant, they controlled the Rand, but they didn't move further. It's one of those times when you've basically got victory. And it's quite clear if they'd attacked Pretoria, they could have seized the basis of government. They didn't attack the army ever. They attacked the police, but they thought they had these illusions that the army, which did prevaricate for it, might come onto their side, but they never did. At the start of the strike, Fisher had written a suicide note, which I can't see Comrade Scargill having done. But he believed in insurrection. There was armed fighting for about 3 weeks. At one time, it looked as though they'd be successful. Eventually, because of the severe air power, they were crushed. And Fisher and Spendiff both committed suicide on the last day of the strike. And there was horrific reaction. Lots of strikers were executed, going to the gallows, singing the Internationale, and just shot down in the street. And for a long time, sort of the ANC in South Africa had very ambivalent about this period. But now, Fisher and Spender and the others have been sort of incorporated into the ANC's history of South Africa as revolutionary fighters who were before had been wiped out. So there's some recompense that Fisher and those who have at last been recognised, and the thing's not been seen as a racist uprising. Right. Fucking hell. I'm going to lead to my last revolutionary, who is Gustav Landauer. I don't know if people might have heard of the Bavarian Workers' Soviet or Munich Workers' Soviet of 1919. Again, in the chaos of Germany, and Bavaria was often seen as something separate, as Rogers mentioned, the Spartacist uprising. In the chaos of Germany, all sorts of different things were going on. Maxhorst was running around. Landau is basically a mystical poet. I mean, he wasn't a street fighter, an insurrectionist at all. Wasn't a great believer in proletarian revolution. He wrote lots of stuff. He's a mystic, he's an anthropologist. He was great. He wanted to make life better for people, but he was a pointy head, basically. We might have called him today. And he was in Berlin in November 1918. Quite, okay, middle, I guess he nice house, mystical poet. I'm all right, I ain't going to get dragged out and killed. And Kurt Eisner, a friend of his, had formed a Soviet Republic in Bavaria and gives Landauer a shout. Says, why don't you come down here? It's all kicking off down here. We formed the Soviet Workers' Republic. You can put all your theories about communitarian. He had lots of theories about communitarian socialism, co-ops, all this kind of stuff, which would quite resonate quite well today. But he wasn't, the establishment of a workers' Soviet wasn't really Gustav Landauer's bag of tricks, basically. But he did not say nothing to do with me, Gov. He thought, something going on there, I'll get down there. So he did. By the time he got there, Eisner, his mate, had been assassinated. And there was a petite power vacuum in Munich. And there was Landauer, other Ernst Toller, Erich Mühsam, all anarchist poets and writers. And they sort of took up the power vacuum. And they said, well, why don't we claim the Bavarian Workers' Soviet? The funny thing was, they said, well, how'd you do that? How'd you proclaim a Soviet? What, did you stick a few posters up? It wasn't like you'd go on telly and announce it. And they said, yeah, probably. So they zoomed around town sticking a load of posters up saying, we proclaimed the first Bavarian Workers' Soviet. But it wasn't that, they did have some support. They had lots of proletarians and so on. The Communist Party, which is the strongest force there, refused to join this. Which is probably the kiss of death, and it's they refused to bring their fighting troops in because they described Landauer as anarchist and it was a bourgeois adventure and so on. There's a great story where Landauer was actually appointed minister. It was one of those days where you sit around the table and say who's going to be minister of this, that and the other. And Landauer was minister of education and did in the... basically they knew they were fucking doomed, basically. They were all going to die. But they thought, well, we've got 4 weeks or so. And Landauer, amazingly enough, with all these right armies and various people, fascists about to descend on Munich, started to institute some reforms in the education program. He brought in egalitarian wages of all lecturers and teachers. He brought in school councils where students would have a say. So it was all in this amazing sort of situation where they were all probably going to die. And Landauer said, if I'd had another week, I might have changed a few more things. There's a great discussion with Mühsam. They're sitting around a table, the forces of reaction are about to invade. There's an argument about who should be Minister of Agriculture in the first Bavarian Workers' Soviet. None of them know much about agriculture. But this conversation goes on for about 5 hours. Rather than get some armed defence together to resist their force, they all go, who's going to land there? Goes, for fuck's sake, we're all going to be dead by the end of the fucking evening. Does it really fucking matter? And that's why I like Landauer, and I'll end, because... people make history, but not in circumstances of their own choosing. It would have been really easy for Landauer to say, well, it's not my bag, I'll give it a miss. Like, he went there and he did his best in the circumstances of the time. He didn't say, oh, well, I'm going to come here when the full programme of workers' councils is delineated or completely anarchist programme. Well, you've got your full programme in, and then I won't, there's something I can disagree with, and I'll cop out of it because I disagree with your programme on fisheries or something. The call came and he went there. And I think that's politically a lesson for us all. The circumstances which arise in history may not be those which we would mean most propitious or beneficial to revolution. But sometimes you have to, as Bobby Seale said, seize the time and get stuck in when and where. And I think some of the people I've talked about today, they could easily have saved their lives. Maria Spiridonova, she could have found reasons not to do what she did. Certainly Percy Fisher could have done, not done what he did. They could all have not done what they did, but they were there. They were proper revolutionaries. They saw the circumstances and they decided to make a revolution in their own time, there and then, at great fucking risk to themselves. And comrades, if we can match that and our own political activity, and if Hydra Bookshop can be a spur to doing that, we'll be in for some great times ahead. Thank you. Let's see. Spiridonova shot, killed by the Stalin. Holtz killed by Stalin. Fisher committed suicide. Radowitzky survived, but as a prole, and Hasek drunk himself to death. So I'm not sure if that's a victim. I suppose it's a form of suicide as well. I think with Hasek, he's had a bloody good laugh while doing it.
Any other questions then?
Well, there's books written about various of these people. So if anyone afterwards wants to approach me, I can give you a nod in the direction of, if you're interested in anyone, who to read more about. And hopefully Hydra will stock these books.
I just want to say a couple of things. Cheers to him for doing that, for coming along. Tomorrow we've got two events, one in the afternoon at 3 o'clock, Steve Higginson. It's called Scout Sunday tomorrow because we've got Steve Higginson in the afternoon talking about 1911 and the strike in Liverpool and gunboats on the Mersey since the 100th anniversary. So there's been a whole load of events in Liverpool in the last few months. And I've got to say, there's been a massive debate about what 1911, if anybody doesn't know anything about a big strike, and Churchill sends the gunboats on the Mersey, trains them on working class areas. And there's been a huge debate in Liverpool about what the content of that moment was in 1911. So Steve's coming down and to put forward his views about it, and particularly the connections with sailors, port, seamen, the IWW, Lucy Parsons, Jim Larkin, James Connolly, and the connections between Chicago and Liverpool, which are all connected to 1911. So it's a new bit of history that's been done recently in research, so it'll be really interesting. And in the evening at 7 o'clock, I think, is that right?
7
o'clock, we've got Sheila Coleman from the Hillsborough Justice Campaign, who came down, I think, a couple of years ago, did an excellent talk. And of course, there's obviously been some recent changes. I think they're a little bit cynical about them, the government finally releasing police papers about Hillsborough. So she'll be talking about that in the evening. So that's 3 o'clock, Steve Higginson, 7 o'clock here, Sheila Coleman. And then we'll be open on Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock to be a coffee shop and a bookshop. So just come down and hang out. That's it, cheers. Sorry.
Question from the floor.
Oh, right, sorry.
Do you have any books on 1911 here at the moment, like specifically sent?
I look blankly around the stock bloke, but he's at home. He's in the pub probably.
Oh, right.
We can find out, yeah.
I've got to be honest, we just got a load of boxes today. I've just got them out of the boxes and put them on the shelf.
Better just to give it a good look around there.
It didn't feel that warm when you haven't got any electricity, so.
Now we have. Sorry, we can't be more specific.
It'll be reorganised by Tuesday.
About half an hour ago.
Also, talking about strikes, if you're on strike next Wednesday, fair play. If you want a free cup of coffee, come in.
Right, so free cup of coffee for strike of it. No more to the castle.
If I ring in sick.
This is a West Ham.
Oh, don't.
Oh, cheers. Anyway, that's a clear cheers.
You're a uni fan.